Dr. Darian Parker is a multi-hyphenate entrepreneur, athlete, and a man of faith, and he is breaking open myths on what it takes to be a Division I student athlete competing at elite levels, on the interior work he has to do to be a good father, on the reality that life is lived at its best and realest without guarantees or known outcomes, but is founded on authentic love for our fellow humans. All we can rely on is our ability to build true relationships with one another and to make a commitment to show up every day, even when the outcomes are unknown or don't go our way. Darian believes that one's life doesn't bloom under the bright lights of fame, accolades, or ego. Instead, it is a relentless dance performed in the powerful spaces of the phrase, "I don't know." For Dr. Parker, the real champions show up daily and do the monotonous grunt work that is a major and essential part of what we call living. Hello, and welcome to a new season of At the Podium with me, Patrick Huey. At the Podium is a multimedia platform that brings together people from a diverse background of lives, careers, and experiences who all share one thing in common. They have stepped fully into the transformative power of finding and raising their voices to make an impact on their communities and our world today. At the Podium holds a space for people to share their stories, to be heard, and to bring us inspiration. Today, I am thrilled to share the podium with Dr. Darian Parker. Dr. Darian Parker earned his PhD in sports education leadership with an emphasis in behavior modification from UNLV. He earned his master and bachelor's degree from James Madison University in kinesiology. Dr. Parker is a certified personal trainer through the NSCA, and Dr. Parker has been in the fitness and wellness business for 21 years. Throughout the course of Dr. Parker's career, he has served several roles in the fitness and wellness industry. He has worked extensively in both the academic and private club sector as a director of education for a career college, general manager of a high-end luxury residential fitness club, and national director of fitness for a global leisure management company. Currently, Dr. Parker is the co-owner of Epic Leisure Management LLC and the owner of Parker Personal Training LLC, and the co-founder of personal and professional wellness development platform FEM. Dr. Parker is a featured writer and presenter for national fitness organizations, and Dr. Parker is also the host and creator of Dr. D's Social Network, a podcast devoted to genuine, open, and honest conversations with people from all over the world. Darian, welcome to At the Podium.
Thank you, Patrick. It's a big honor to be on here with you.
It is such a pleasure to have you on. I know we've been connecting over the past couple of years, talking about health, wellness, and fitness. And so now we actually have the conversation about it.
Yes. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
I am too. And you know, as I was doing my research for today's conversation with you, I discovered that at James Madison, which is a Division I school, when you were getting your degree there, you were a sprinter in track and field. And I was really intrigued by this, not only because you were living the life of a college student athlete, but because running is one of those sports that people have very divergent views on. They tend to fall into two different camps. You have those people who love, love, love to run, and then you have those people who really don't love to run. I tend to fall into the category of, I would rather do 1,000 sit-ups and push-ups than run. So why do you think that people have such diametrically opposed views of running?
I think one of the first things it goes back to, running has always been punitive in team sports for a lot of people, like in high school, especially a lot of your team sports, running is punishment if you don't do well. I'm not sure how that is now in that environment. I've been removed from that a long time, but it's always such a punitive thing. It was like the connotation was, you didn't do well, so go run. This is not good type of thing, you know?
Right.
And I think that just became kind of this pervasive thing. There's almost this trauma of running from the past for people.
What did you learn from being a student athlete in college? It's such a unique existence. And it's interesting. Student athletes lead very different lives in the college university. So what was that like for you?
I think it was, I thought it was really good for me because I crave structure as a person. And that is the ultimate structure. I mean, you have to take classes at a certain time, always 8 a.m. classes. You couldn't take anything in the afternoon. And you always knew where you're going to be at all times during the day. So for me, it was great. I was like, this is awesome. I know where I'm going to be. Lots of structure, lots of being tested on a daily basis, especially with running, is very painful. When you're doing it at a high level, the training is excruciating because you're constantly pushing yourself to get better. And that also, I think, goes back to your question about running. Running's painful also. Like, especially when you first start, it feels horrible. But people don't recognize it. Like, when you get really good at it too, it's not like it gets that much easier either. I mean, you're running faster and you're creating even more intensity. So whereas a lot of sports, you know, if you're shooting a ball through a hoop or throwing a pass, there's a lot of joy in that and hitting something or receiving something. And running, you're just going around and around in an oval, or you're running through the woods, or you're on the street, and it's very monotonous.
So then why do it? What are you getting? You must be getting something.
I mean, I love the fitness behind it. I was always into fitness growing up, but I mean, in all honesty, like, I got a scholarship, so it helped me go to college.
Yeah.
So it was also a business for me too, in that sense. But I think it also hardened me in the sense that, like, I was being tested all the time, physically, mentally, socially, emotionally, that it made me have perspective. It's like, man, I can't imagine what it's like being like a regular student. It seems so easy. Like, you don't have to, like, you just sleep whenever you want, kind of get up and do it. Like, oh, you have all this time. Like, right. How's that possible? Like, I had no time, you know?
I'm sure the regular students might have a different perspective.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Right. You know? But right. What do you think really what's the X factor from the good student athlete to the great student athlete? Because obviously, as people enter the more professional sports arenas, those numbers diminish significantly in terms of who's going to cross over into that rarefied world of being a professional athlete. What do you think, from being on the inside of that, is the X factor that makes that difference for that person who ascends to that level?
The first thing is the talent, overwhelming talent. You have to have a good base for amazing talent. And then after that, I think what really separates is the consistency and the work ethic, because most of what you see on any sport, collegiately especially, is you spend way more time practicing than you do competing. It's like a 90-10. It's crazy. So being okay with the monotony of practicing, of pushing yourself, no one's watching you, there's no cameras and stuff. It's just always, you're grinding all the time. And I think that's the disconnect between the public and athletes. It's all you see is the performance. But for the athlete, the performance is so little of what the experience is for that. So I think, but greatness, I think, is the athlete who is very talented, but also is supremely consistent and actually somewhat enjoys the monotonous, tedious nature of the practice of the sport.
I've never heard anyone describe their sport as monotonous, which is an interesting adjective, but that's... It's interesting because I feel like there's a perception that there is this sort of mythic experience when one is a student athlete trying to become a professional athlete, but you're really describing it as really grunt labor in many ways just to get the job done.
That's all it is. Most of your Olympic sports, especially your swimming, your diving, track and field, softball, whatever it may be, basketball, football may be a little different. But I think I've talked to so many athletes over my life, and being a student athlete, you know, when you go to the dining hall, you see a lot of your colleagues or other athletes in different sports, and it's pretty similar. Everybody has this very isolated feeling. Mm. And the majority of the time is practice, constant practice. way more than the NCAA said you're allowed to do, by the way. You're supposed to only practice 20 hours a week. Way more than that. Anybody will tell you that. Way more than that.
So do you think of running? Did you think of running? And I know now your career and your life is really built around fitness and wellness. Yeah. But at that time, did you view running as a passion or was it something else for you?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I was ever passionate about running. And I still like to run. I still sprint. I like sprinting. I enjoy that. I wouldn't say I love it, but it definitely is something that it comes to me easily. And I think, honestly, a lot of athletes are like that. The sports that they're in, it comes easy to them or it's a talent they have. But I think very few athletes actually love the sport they're in. Very few athletes love and eat their sport. That's very few people.
That's really interesting to hear. I wonder if I can find someone who has a different perspective on that.
Yeah.
The love of what they do.
A lot of distance runners love running. They continue to do 5Ks and marathons when they're done collegiately. Sprinters, most of the time, listen, I went there to school for this. It helped me get an education. Maybe they love the competition of sprinting, running fast. But again, when I would talk to other athletes, I'm not sure that they love their sport that much. I think it was a means to an end, especially in college, because you lose a lot of the love for your sport in college because it becomes a job. It becomes very regimented. It's very job-like at that point. But even heard Tony Gonzalez, Hall of Fame, tight end for the Kansas City Chiefs, and he was asked, how many athletes love football? He said, I think in the NFL, maybe 3% of the people love football. It was a passion, but it also hurts. I mean, if you went to your job and it hurt most of the time, would you love it?
That's a very complicated question.
Yeah. Okay, there's some other stuff going on.
The pain may not be physical. But
okay, right. But the physical pain, at least, especially in running, is constant. It's constant. I think in maybe your collision sports, the physical pain from the trauma of getting hit is probably way worse.
It's you're sort of, again, you're breaking open the myth around this idea of the athlete. I guess because if one is able to ascend to those heights, the benefits, the compensation, the fame, the access is so profound.
Yeah.
People may be willing to be in a car accident essentially every week or experience the pain of running every week in order to achieve that.
Yeah. I mean, when I was in college, we had a lot of people quit the team regularly. It was just too hard over and over again. It's just it's nerve-wracking to come into a practice and to know you're going to be at your limit most of the days. And it's going to be so incredibly painful. And you're doing that for the opportunity to maybe do well in a meet on the weekend. And then you get the social, emotional, the head games going into practice. Like, this is going to be so hard. Like, man, it's going to be so tough. it's like, it's hard to love something like that. I mean, I enjoyed the physicality of it. And I still do a lot of the workouts I did in college. I love sprint workouts, but I would say that's pretty rare.
So now your career is really steeped in the world of fitness and wellness. So coming from, and then you went on to study to get your doctorate in sports leadership, I believe, in behavioral modification. So how did you make that leap in your mind from being student athlete to then professionalizing what was a passion in high school, perhaps a means to an end in your college years, and now it's your career. So how did you make that leap to doing that?
I think in the beginning it was hard to not be an athlete initially. It's funny, I hear people say, like recreational folks that go, I'm an athlete. I'm like, man, I don't know, man. I'm like, I think, what does that mean? I mean, for me, being an athlete was hard to let go of because it was constant competition, constant practice. I had a hard time letting it go because even though it was painful a lot, like you can get used to anything over time.
Right.
You know, people are very adaptable. And even the pain, you come to like expect it. And I think I had to release myself from that mental feeling, that hardness that I would have every day of like putting on the vest. And in my mind of like, I'm going to go through something very difficult most days.
Right.
And so I was like, it was hard to let go of that and then start working with kind of the general population. Cause you know, I was in a very highly athletic population where everybody looked like me, was super fit. And then I think that part of my life shaped a huge part of my current physical fitness life. Like I never mind working extremely hard because I'm like, well, it can't be worse than what I did. I'm like, it can never be that difficult. But I also find weirdly, I kind of strangely want that feeling also. I want to be like where I question if I could do something or not. I like thrive in that space. So while I didn't like maybe love the constantly feeling tired, there was a part of me that did feel very drawn to it in a weird way for that. So what was hard for me in the transition was then I'm around people who were always like, I don't like exercise. I don't want to work hard. And I was like, wait a minute. All I know is hard work. I mean, I don't know this other side of like people struggle with doing exercise regularly. So I had to really make this transition. Like, I don't want to make it about the hardcore science of exercise. I want to make it about building relationships with people and just build solid, warm, inviting, vulnerable relationships with people that happen to have exercise as part of the equation.
So for you, it's more about the relationship than helping somebody get a great set of abs.
Yes. Yeah. I felt like because even like athletes, I think was interesting. Everybody thinks, you know, I want to look like that person. I want to have like, look at that athlete's body. Look at all these people. But there's a cost to that, to your health as well for training that hard. But the other thing is you'll never think you look good enough. Even when you're in tremendous shape, most people still want more. They're addicted to looking better. You can never look better in your mind. It's like, oh, it never looked like how you want to be.
Right.
It's always this weird mirror and you see yourself and we have this weird distorted image. Even if somebody tells you you look good, you're like, I could look better. So many clients are like that. Oh, I could be better. I could lose this. I could do that. I was like, you know what? Let's focus on defining what exercise is, what physical activity is, what movement is. But let's focus on just you showing up regularly, being accountable. We'll put the plan together. But more than anything, we need to focus on having a good relationship with each other. The rest, I think, falls in place when you develop good personal skills with people, which is why I did my doctorate in behavior modification. I was like, I think this means more. Dealing with people and helping them, having compassion with them, helping to suffer. That's the word compassion comes from the Latin term compati, meaning to suffer with. And I suffer with all my teammates all the time. Why wouldn't I do that with my clients? You know?
So is that the behavior modification? That the behavior has to change in order for there to be a physical change. Is that the reason why people will not be able to keep up their New Year's resolutions every year because they don't make the modifications?
I think one of the reasons why is it's a biological aspect too, is that people, our ancestors probably ever dreamed that we would be exercising like this and that people would be running for health purposes because our biology is littered with the history of exercise for the purpose of survival, hunting, gathering. This still happens in a lot of places in the world. It's less and less common. But biologically, this is strange what we're doing, you know, going to a gym, running outside. I don't think that people are lazy. I think they're trying to override a biological system that's telling them, you shouldn't be doing this. Like, we keep our calories for certain things. But our lifestyles have become such that it's so much easier to take the activity out of living now because of all the technology and where we're going. So we almost have to be involved in these things. So I try to educate people about that and then help them understand, like, listen, especially if you're working with someone or if you're having trouble, it's like the accountability part is a huge part of it. Having something, being tethered to something emotionally, normally will keep you invested into something. Now, whether that emotional tether is good or bad, that's another thing, because people can be tethered to bad things and do it forever, or good things and do it forever, you know.
Right.
What is that relationship? So I really focus on building the relationship with people and understand everybody has different body types and different phases of life that they're in, but just to understand them, validate them is most important initially.
So how do you set realistic expectations then if you are in a situation where you have to take in all these different factors of a person's life, where they are, their age, maybe even their zip code, which we should talk about.
Yes.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is A, why you even want to do that, and B, yeah. how you do that.
Yeah, I know for me, like when I work with people, is to one, just make myself as human as possible to people. I'm a flawed individual. I don't know everything. I may have my doctorate, but I'm not going to tell you things that I don't know. Like I don't know was a powerful tool. It's like everybody, I feel like, is always trying to, because we have all this information, it's like everybody's an expert at something. I'm like, yes, I have things I know a lot about, but I'm always learning. And there are questions that I'm going to tell you, I'm going to give you the answer, I don't know. It's like somebody wants to ask me, well, where do you think I'll be in 6 months? Like, honestly, no one could answer that question. No one knows. And anybody who tells you that, they're literally just blowing smoke. Like, it's like, I don't know where your frequency is going to be, how often you're going to show up, how is your sleep? What are your nutritional habits? What's your personal relationships like? I mean, there's just a list to run down. And I say, listen, this, if we're not focusing on all these things, then more than likely you're not going to be where you want to be. How will you respond to the stimulus of exercise that I provide for you? Everybody responds differently to exercise. So I try to be super honest with people and go, I can't give you all the answers in the beginning, but what I can tell you is that if we have an emotional tether to each other and you have accountability, you have something on your calendar regularly and you show up regularly, something good is going to happen. I just can't tell you what that's going to be specifically for you, because how would anybody know that?
How do people respond to that? Because people like guarantees. People want to know, in 6 months, I'm going to be a size 32 waist. My chest will look like this. You're asking the people to take a much deeper look in terms of their life than just the hour or two a week they may spend in a gym.
They respond incredibly well to it, because I think no one's ever told them that generally. I think people are always trying to get the sale. Mm-hmm. And I'm not worried about that. I'm just like, listen, if you want a guarantee, I'm not your person for that. But I will tell you that you'll keep searching for that guarantee, because no one's going to give you that day one. I can guarantee that I'll show up regularly and I'll do my job. Can you guarantee that you'll show up regularly? And I tell people this straight up, and I think they enjoy the honesty that I have with them. And I think my record speaks for it. I've been training for over 22 years. The majority of my clients have been with me most of that time. I have longevity with clients, but I think it's because I focus on being truthful. I don't want to tell people here's the cliche answer, or like, here's, I just want to be like fearless and be like, listen, sometimes it's not like that. Like, it's okay to, like, you know, I think a lot of things in life is like, what's actually behind the curtain?
Right.
And I want to always have people come behind my curtain and be like, this is me, everything, man, all the good stuff, all the bad stuff. But I promise you, I'll always be working on me. I'll always be doing to try to get better. You know,
I love that.
And people struggle. They don't have a lot of people in their lives that they're vulnerable with. I want to be that for them.
Now, you said something really profound. A friend of mine, Attica Locke, who is a very successful author of mystery and suspense novels, she and I were once talking about the challenges in the creative artistic process. And those challenges seem very familiar to what you describe. And during my conversation with Attica, she said, and I will never forget it, she said, sometimes the victory is just in showing up. And you just articulated the exact same thought, that the victory is in showing up. It's in showing up. And sometimes you just have to let the results, you know, fall where they may, but you still have to show up.
Yeah, I think showing up every day is critically important in anything you do in your life, your relationships, with exercise, with your family, whatever it is. And I just think it's we make promises all the time about fitness. And to be fair, I think our business has had horrible messaging in this. We promise people 30, 60, 90 day results all the time in advertising, or we tell people, you know, you got a problem, take this drug. Even though your lifestyle behavior is generally much, behavior change is much more effective than the drug, much more effective. But we're overcoming this idea that you're doing something that's very counterintuitive to you already. And that generally doesn't feel good when you push yourself and you do something that's different, doesn't feel good. It's not like you're eating ice cream and it feels great. It's like, you know, when you're trying to improve, it's uncomfortable. It can be uncomfortable. So for me, I just said, let's just focus on us. Let's build our relationship. You show up. I'm going to give you the stimulus you need to do well. We'll see how you respond. That'll show where we're going to move next. But all you got to do is show up. Show up regularly. Let's tether to each other emotionally. Great things are going to happen. I just can't tell you specifically like what'll be for you. But you got to trust me. It's all trust, you know?
Right. What role in terms of health and fitness and wellness does zip code play?
Huge. And actually, I had a guest on my podcast, Sarah Diss, who this was her dissertation. It was actually around based on zip code health. And that we know more than ever that migration patterns of people, where they live, the type of environment is urban versus more rural, particular parts of the country that are more outdoors based. We know that your zip code creates a huge level of engagement for fitness and wellness practices. Mm. But then also there's other aspects. What is the pollution in the air? Are you in a state where there is a lot of access to different things? So I think it's not publicized enough, but I think if you're in a place where maybe the activity of being physical is really downplayed, it's just another barrier. And the goal, I think, for me is to always tell people, how can we reduce the friction for your ability? There's a lot of friction for your ability to be consistent. What are those friction points? Is it your zip code? Is it your significant other? Is it your job? Is it your sleeping patterns? What are those friction points? We need to either decrease or eliminate that friction so that you can freely feel open to move into this area of your life.
Wow, removing the friction points. As I've never heard that concept before. The friction points.
Yeah.
I think another topic around this idea of zip code and health and wellness is this whole uncomfortable conversation about obesity in America today and how we're supposed to talk about it. And we see people like Jillian Michaels, who has gotten into a lot of trouble around the language she's used around issues of obesity. And how we talk about body positive images for people who may be overweight or obese. What is your view of that very complicated issue today?
I mean, this is a very big topic. And I want to be respectful as possible. Because I think respectfulness and courteousness is really important in our society. Always has been, but I think currently very much for that. But there's kind of these two schools of thoughts, or maybe more, where there's kind of a segment of folks who are like, we shouldn't even say obesity. We don't want to feel like we're shaming people and things like that. But there's another segment, it's like obesity or overweight, these are clinical terms. These are medical terms. They're not like meant to be derogatory towards people and things of that nature. But from the very scientific point of view, we have tremendous amounts of data. We know that overweight and especially obesity and morbid obesity are devastating to the human body. Hmm. And we know that they cause a cascading effect, which is that they are the trigger point, almost the gun for diabetes, cardiovascular disease, any metabolic disease, you name it. Huge, huge correlation for that. So that's the reality behind it. We can choose to ignore that. But it's just the truth behind it. It's not like something made up. So right. I think we don't need to be derogatory to people and tell people that they're just a bad person because they don't take care of themselves. It's just much more complicated than that. And I think that's where kind of people in public like Jillian Michaels, they get in trouble. They're in a bubble and they don't realize it themselves. You know, it's not like they're working with the general population most of the time. They're in a very Hollywood isolated bubble for that, and which I think is dangerous. So I think we need to have the conversation. The numbers are staggering. 42% of the U.S. population is obese. When you add in overweight, the United States overweight and obese population is around 69 to 70%. That's staggering. With nothing on the horizon saying that that's going to fall anytime soon. This is the housing crisis, the bubble. That won't be a bubble. It's just going to keep going up. There is no intervention at this point that will decrease this train, which is happening right now. So we need to take it serious, but we also shouldn't bring it down to like the people are lazy and stuff. I don't believe that. I think there are a lot of circumstances surrounding this, where you grew up, what have been the habits, behaviors you've been told or what you believe, all these different things, biodiversity of body types, a lot of different things. But we can't escape the fact that it's an extremely dangerous state of being to be in. It just is.
And how do we marry that? Because I think we are in a moment in our zeitgeist in the culture where we don't want to make an artist feel badly because she may not be a certain size or a certain weight. So how do we balance the science and the knowledge of a person being obese or morbidly obese or even overweight has very serious physical results from that could shorten their life, et cetera.
Right.
With the idea of that may be, but you still have a right to exist, even if you aren't a size zero, which may not be the best place for you to be either.
Right. Right.
So that's the friction point that you.
That's the friction.
About.
We got to decrease the friction.
Decrease
on that.
Friction.
I think we got to change the message and we need to change the messengers. That's what we need to change. If we have to have people who are willing to go on and stop creating this very toxic language about this stuff. But we also can have people who are just deniers who go like, well, that's a bad word to say. Like diabetes isn't great either. Cardiovascular disease isn't great either, but nobody's saying that's like a bad word. I mean, it's like, I think there's some level of acceptance, but I think it starts with the messengers. If the messengers convey things in a very simple way, and say, hey, listen, this is what our current level of science, because science is only as good as the time it's in. Maybe that'll change. Currently, we know this is not great. However, you deserve to do the things you want to do. And we want to empower you. But just so you know, here's the information. Now, it's much like sleep. We know now more than ever so much information on the power of sleep. Mm. Now, whatever you choose to do with that, that's your personal choice.
Right.
But we know the dangers of not getting good sleep. So it's saying, here's the dangers of overweight and obesity, but you have to make a choice on where you're going to be on this and getting the help. If you don't get the help and you're like, hey, I love this, this is who I am, like, okay, but you have to be aware that there are consequences to behaviors. It's not canceling people. It's just saying, here's the consequences of these behaviors. If you're willing to accept those, more power to you, you know?
Where did all this come from within you? This, the ability to overcome the pain, the discomfort of being a student athlete, the ability to sort of understand the deep relationship around what health and wellness can be for people and building true relationships and not just focusing on chest size or the number of abs you have. Where did all that come from and start with you?
I think one thing I think for me is, starting in my life, I have two very active parents growing up. So they really pushed physical activity and exercise in our lives. Also, just the community of faith that I've been in my whole life, my faith community and espousing love, loving other people is a big tenet of anybody who's in a faith-based community and actually meaning it, not just saying it, you know?
Right.
And so I wanted that. I think the other thing, when I got into college, I wanted to really arm myself with as much interpersonal relationship-based skills that I could, because I figured out really early that this human thing is really about emotion. And so I wanted to arm myself with as much information and coping mechanisms to work with other people in my life. So that was through public speaking. I took public speaking in college because I wanted to get rid of my fear of being able to be an orator to other people and talk to people. My bachelor's degree program had us all have therapists for 6 months. So I learned to deal with my own issues, take care of myself, and really confront the things that I had going on. And then I took philosophy every step of the way up the course of my education so that I could learn how to argue and understand philosophical points of views with people and argue in a tangible, factual point of view, but not try to be right for that. So that when I would start my practice, I would have all this information and all of these coping mechanisms to be able to meet the needs and demands of other humans in a way that made them feel validated, made them feel warm, and made them feel like, you know what, I'm being taken care of here. And that's what people need their basic needs met. They need to feel safe. They need to feel loved. They need to feel cared for. And what the surprising thing and the sad thing is, a lot of humans don't receive that in their life growing up. They're just surviving. They're never being loved. And I'm like, I need to be this version of this for them in their life.
You said in your studies, you studied philosophy. Is that where your poetry comes from that you write?
Yes. Yeah, a lot of it. Because what was studied, like idealism, pragmatism, naturalism, and all these things. And you're a combination of all these different things. But I think initially it kind of, we would spend time during class arguing with each other. So you would always have to argue every day, but you had to like learn how to argue. So it was arguing is not just like something you do. It's a skill like anything. So I learned that. And then you also had to argue a point you didn't believe regularly, which also was something very different. This is a great exercise. Get with somebody and pick a topic and pick the point of view that you completely don't believe in and argue it to another person. It's a great exercise because it'll help you understand the other person's point of view. Oh my gosh, we need that.
And you know, it's interesting because we live in echo chambers now. We don't even know the other side of the arguments of the statements that we make because we just don't communicate anymore.
We don't communicate.
With people outside of our zip codes.
Yes.
Literally and figuratively, we do not communicate.
That's right. These important things. So that just pushed my poetry. I was like, okay, so it just got me more creative and wanted to talk about it was a great way to talk about my feelings and get those on paper. I'm always working on myself. For me, my business is always about how can I keep improving myself so I can be better in my business for other people. And I think sometimes we get this attitude of like, you know, I just want to be ambitious and get stuff, help other people. But it's hard to help people when you're a mess. You know, it's like, well, you got to look inside first. If you're not good inside your own self, it's very difficult to guide other people.
You also have a child. You have one or two children?
I have one child.
One child. What is fatherhood? Years old.
Yeah.
What has fatherhood taught you?
Patience. Lots of patience, and that I needed to do more work on myself. The best thing gift you can give your child is a more well-developed version of yourself to that person.
Wow. Wow.
And I think a lot of people are highly underdeveloped when they become a parent. So their emotional compass is very messy, but then they're trying to guide another human. And I just think there's a mismatch, like spend the time developing yourself, creating coping mechanisms. And even if you do all that, it's still incredibly hard. It's still incredibly challenging to do it. But I think mainly patience for that. But I feel good. Like, I feel like I am always working on the inner me so that I can help develop a better inner person for another person.
So this season 2 of At the Podium, we're really focusing on people who found their voice and are helping their communities, the world in some cases. Do you feel that you have found your voice? Are you in process of finding your voice? What is that for you?
I've definitely found my voice. I think my voice over these past 22 years, the development has been, being in fitness as someone who is a conduit for goodness and kindness for other people, and for appreciating the process of developing the self in order to develop other people around me. Like, I need to have my stuff together. I need to be emotionally stable and available. And that's kind of my calling card: emotional stability, availability, vulnerability, intervention change, be a good person. And if I can consistently be that all the time with other people, then I have created the life that I've always wanted. Always.
Wow. Dr. Darian Parker, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it. I appreciate your availability and your heart in this conversation. So thank you.
Thank you, Patrick.
And to those of you who are watching or listening, remember, we all have a voice, so use yours wisely. Thank you.